My name's Rita.
Rick.
My name's Lee Kezik.
Diane Wilson.
Monica.
My name's Olivia Hammond.
Hi, this is Doan Perry from Jethro Tull, and you are listening to ConcertBlast.com.
Hasbrook,
along with Tom Thompson,
and welcome to Concert Blast. We're here at Chastain Park in Atlanta, Georgia, talking with
Dom Perry
of Jethro Tull, our other partner Mike Arnold, who couldn't be here because his daughter's home from college, and he just thought that was the best thing to do, and I don't blame him.
Yeah, I understand. It was probably better for him to be there for and avoid any domestic trouble. By
that's exactly right.
No. Yeah, that's right.
Good evening, Don. How are you doing?
Nice to be here.
Okay, great. Appreciate it.
We're glad to be here. We want to thank you for definitely taking the time to.
Absolutely,
my pleasure. Oh, your cell phone's.
Turn it off.
Technology interfering again, I know. Fortunately, we don't hear as much in that in the audience as we did when people first got cell phones. People now have a little better manners in turning them off.
And see a lot of blue lights going on and off.
Well, we see them. Sometimes people dial their friends or their phone machine or whatever it is, and I can see them holding it up. However, anybody who's ever had anybody hold up a cell phone at a concert knows just how bad the audio is, and sometimes you don't even know who you're listening to. It's just a garbled mess.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the quality's not that good at all.
Not that good.
For those people who don't really know much about you, can you give them just a synopsis of your background?
Oh, dear.
Encapsulate it. Maybe.
They can probably find out more than they ever wanted to know on the Internet if they
probably
go to
right.
the Jethro Tull website. You know, I'm from New York City, was born and raised there, studied music there, played a lot of different styles, studied a lot of different styles from classical to jazz, rock, pop, folk, ethnic, world music, fusion music, every kind of music you can imagine. I had a chance to play there, and I had a chance to study, and I got to work with musicians in all those different genres. So my background in music in New York really helped me a lot in preparing me for playing drums in Jethro Tull, which is a bit like playing in an orchestra in the sense that it demands diverse styles and influences. So the fact that I was exposed to that and had a chance to play that enabled me to deal with the music more easily of Jethro Tull.
Whom or what influenced you to take up drums?
I remember I thought the Beatles invented pop music. I had no idea about pop music. I'd heard jazz, yeah. Some jazz around the house, but I really only knew orchestral music. And until I was, 10 or 11, the Beatles came along, and then it was the Beatles. I thought, and I looked at Ringo playing the drums, and I thought, that looks like a good job. And I started playing, and a year later I was in a band. And we played. I was 11 or 12, been playing a year, and I got to play this concert at Hunter College in New York, and we were opening for Otis Redding and Booker T and the MGs.
Oh, wow.
And a group called the Critters and the Royal Guardsmen. And I thought I knew everything about drums. I mean, I was all at 12 years old, and I'd been playing a whole year, and I thought, you couldn't tell me anything. And then Al Jackson, who was playing drums for Otis Redding and Booker T, came on, and I realized I knew nothing. But I remember when I went out there, and Cousin Brucey, who was the big DJ in New York at the time, introduced me, and I walked out, and all these girls screamed. And I remember thinking, this is a good job. I could do this.
Absolutely.
So,
good influence.
Yeah. That's kind of how that started.
Wow. And we know you've been with Tull since 83, is that correct?
End of 83, beginning of 84, I think it was. So it's been over 21 years now.
And how did you come about getting the gig with Tull?
The initial connection, I had worked with Pat Benatar, who was on the same label as Jethro Tull on Chrysalis. The man who had produced Pat had, unbeknownst to me, told Ian about me, but he didn't know where I was and didn't know if I was available or interested. And he said, when Ian was looking for drummers and they started looking in America, he said, well, I know one fellow who might be appropriate. Another friend of mine called me and said he happened to see an ad in the Village Voice that Ian had taken out, and I was in California at the time, and he said, I'm not sure, if it or what, but I thought about it. And then I called Chrysalis, and they said, well, if you're going to send anything, you've got to, it was Tuesday now, you has to be there by Friday, because we've had about 500 or 600 tapes have come in, and we're sending the last box off on Friday. Mm. So I thought, well, let me see if I can get through to my friend Jeff there. And when I got to him, he says, I can't believe you called me, because I've been telling Ian about you, but I didn't know where you were, if you were around. So anyway, he told Ian to keep an eye out for my stuff, and then Ian listened to it, and he called me a couple weeks later, said he liked, and it kind of got narrowed down, and then he asked me if I'd prepare a few things and over and play, which I did, and then I got it, apparently, and I'm still here 21 years later.
Going strong.
Yeah, it's still a good fit. Good.
Absolutely.
We know your tour schedule is extremely strenuous, and there's not a whole lot of days off there. What do you do when you do have an off day?
Well, these days, I kind of take it easy. I used to be the sort of tour director and go out and museums and all these cultural things, and I find these days just conserving my energy. Most of the time I usually stay at the hotel. I mean, I might go out for a walk. I like to read. That's my favorite pastime. So I usually read. At various times I have brought, a small little sort of miniature writing setup on the road so that I can do some composing. And then I can upload that to my bigger studio when I get home. But then, of course, I find these days with computers and email, I am always so far behind on my email that I often find myself just trying to catch up on that. I've got, 40 emails to deal with tomorrow, I think, that I just want to try to get ahead of.
Do you try to answer the email?
These aren't the fan emails. I can't. No, this is personal.
Just personal emails.
No,
okay.
I'm way behind. The fan emails, I'd like to say to any of the fans who've written in that I do read them, and I really appreciate everybody writing. It is impossible for me to answer all of them. There's just far too many that come in, and I try to answer the ones that I can. But if you don't get an answer, don't think that I don't read them, and don't think that I don't appreciate getting them. I do enjoy reading all of them, but if I answered all of them, I wouldn't even have time to go out there and play gigs.
Oh, you would.
So I'm bad enough on my personal email trying to keep in front of that.
Yeah, I believe it.
Can you describe for us just a day on tour with Tull? What all that encompasses in daily life?
Well, it depends. One, if I have sort of two different modes of transportation when we're on tour in America or Europe. I prefer going on the ground. I really find flying these days is a fairly hostile experience. So I try to avoid that. Very often I will go on the tour bus, or the crew tour bus overnight, which I find more relaxing. I can wind down naturally after a concert, go to sleep, and wake up, and I'm at the venue. But sometimes it's necessary that, you know, I'll go back to the hotel, and then we fly tomorrow to Dallas. On a gig day, very often, if we get there, if I arrive at the hotel, say, at noon, I'll go and have some lunch, give us some email, maybe we have some of this sort of stuff to do, just PR stuff to do. Might take a little bit of time in the afternoon, and then if I have any time to read or relax, that's nice, but then the day is cut in half by the sound check. And then there is the little bit of time between sound check and the gig, and sometimes we have meet and greet or again this sort of thing that we're doing now.
Oh,
and then I try to warm up for the gig. As you can see, I have a little practice kit in here, and get myself sort of mentally prepared and physically prepared and relaxed and stretched and all of that in order to do the concert. Then we do the gig, and sometimes we have a meet and greet afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And depending on where that is, if that's in cities where I know a lot of people, that can be like a gig after the gig.
I believe that.
Oh, yeah.
Just dealing with all of that. And then I get to have dinner.
Finally.
And, yeah, finally. I don't eat before the show. That's just dangerous for me. I find that it's better for me. It's like a runner.
To
play kind of light.
Yeah.
You know, I eat in the afternoon, and then I'll eat after the show, and then try to kind of wind down and, you know, get a reasonable rest. And then it all begins again the next day.
After this tour, do you have any type of projects or anything going on?
A couple of things, yeah. There's Thread, which is a collaborative project that I've had going for a couple of years. We're going to start a new Thread album, hope in January. I've been writing for that, and Vince DiCola, my partner, is writing, and we are then going to get together and see what we both have. And then we also write a lot of stuff together, and we're working with, also on this album, in addition to Ellis Hall, our singer, Roine Stolte from the Flower Kings, this wonderful Swedish group. Roine is the lead guitar player and main writer in that group, and he's going to join us on this Thread record. I also have some other recordings that I am involved with. In addition to when I'm at home, I spend a lot of time just writing in my studio, some of which will not end up on the next Thread record. It may be just for a project completely of my own that I do sort of more or less myself. And the technology these days allows me to be able to record everything at home, and though I might have a couple of people in to work on it, that's something that I enjoy so much these days is composition. I find that probably when my touring days are over, I'll find myself writing more and more. And I like writing. I like working with words. I mean, apart from the lyrics, which I also do with Thread, I also enjoy writing stories, and I've been writing for some different publications, and sometimes I write for a website update, thinking about working in a longer form in that way. I have plenty to occupy me creatively, and then my wife tries to get me to take some time off. I do want to have a balanced home life and work life, but when I'm home, I always tend to be working on creative things as well. So.
Yeah, we were wondering, you mentioned, we saw your little practice drum kit here that you must use for warm-ups. Is this pretty much how you physically and mentally prepare for a gig? Or?
Well, mentally it's a little different. I mean, I also, as you see, I have, these are tapes from the previous show that I listen to. I review things to see what works, what doesn't work. Keep the happy accidents and discard the things that aren't working.
Yeah,
so I review those. And I also, in my iPod, I have a huge range of things I listen to that might kind of get me in the mood for playing. Sometimes I play alone. I also have practice and study materials I carry with me, so I'll work on those given time, and that, so those all provide different forms of physical and mental warm-up for me.
Well, we all know you have a very formal background, Juilliard, NYU. Do you pretty much endorse a formal musical education, or do you?
I don't endorse anything one way or another. That just happened to be what I got, a cross section of formal education and a lot of practical on the job education, and I endorse both, really. I think that having real world experience cannot be beaten. And one of the bones of contention when I was in school was that I was always working. I was working in studios. I was touring. And they said, well, look, either you're a student or you're not. And I actually was doing, while I was in school, I think what most people wanted to do when they graduated. And I recognized that. I thought, if I don't take that chance now, I may never get some of these opportunities again, which is why I didn't finish my formal schooling. In some ways, I wish I had, because there was certain things that I would have loved to have had more time studying. But as I say, I'm always a student. And when I'm home, I'm practicing. I actually tend to play the piano more at home than I play the drums. And that is something that often I think, I'd love to go back to school and really learn how to orchestrate music properly. You know, things, some of those things that I just missed because I was, you know, working. But I have to say, I'm glad I made the decision I made, because I might not have ended up where I am now if I had just stayed in school and turned away the practical work.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows what could happen?
Well, we were seeing a lot of your influence tend to be jazz and classical. I've noticed a lot of jazz players that you influences. If you could work with any of those people, who would you like to work with?
Well, certainly at the top of the list would have to be Joe Zawinul from Weather Report. I was a huge Weather Report fan, and I love his music. I just think he's a tremendous composer, and he's brought a lot of different influences, again, from, you know, classical and Middle European music and jazz and Austrian folk music, all these things. Stefan Grappelli, though he's not alive with us, he would have been somebody I would have loved to play with. One person that I was really lucky, at the age of 19, I got to play in a man named Tio Macero's big band. Tio Macero was Miles Davis's producer from the mid-60s to the very end, and he was really the architect of Miles's sound. And I was very lucky to get picked to play in his big band, which was incredibly scary and very challenging. And now I look at it and I think, oh, if I could do it now, I could do it so much better. But I managed to hang in there, and that was one of those experiences I think I was very, very fortunate to have. There are so many artists that I would have loved to. I'd love to have played in the New York Philharmonic.
Oh, wow.
I would have loved to play with, you know, Sting or Steely Dan. You know, they're still around. Sure. That could happen.
Did you ever get to play with Jaco Pastorius?
No. I've worked with some of the Weather Report guys outside of Weather Report.
Right.
And I know a number of people that knew him well and played with him. And what an incredibly gifted artist. But I read his... biography about a year ago by Bill Milkowski, and it was, at one point I had to put it down because it really was kind of a tragic tale. I mean, I was such a fan of his, and just to think that this guy went through so much and seemed to have so many problems that unfortunately led to his demise was very disheartening. And so I had to put it down and take a break, and then I came back later on and finished the book. But I would have loved to have worked with him, but he was he led a very troubled life and not a very happy one, I think. But yeah, it's the same with some really gifted artists this happens to, and he just wasn't able to kind of keep it all pulled together somehow.
Our audiences, they love to find out how audiences, especially in different countries, react. Anything that stands out that you can think of that said, oh, yeah, this particular country was just, this audience just
do they
did whatever.
Differently,
you know,
to your music in America versus Europe versus Asia.
They do. I actually have begun to to see a pattern where I believe it really has to do with the climate. I have noticed that in the hot weather countries, they're more demonstrative in their appreciation. They are, say, when we play Scandinavia or England or places like that, places that are colder, they're more reserved, very appreciative, they really listen. Then when we go to Italy, Spain, South America, India, they're completely nuts and wild. Yeah. And I think that that has to do with the heat and the climate.
Really?
I really do, because I noticed that it doesn't matter where it is. I mean, in the same in America. Mm-hmm. You see the audiences in Montana or Vermont, you know, or Oregon are going to be a lot more reserved than the audiences down in Texas and Florida and Mississippi, you know, and Louisiana. So I don't know what it is about that, but I do see a direct correlation between climate and probably lack of inhibition.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. What's one of the craziest, strangest, weirdest thing that you've ever seen happen out there in the audience?
That you're comfortable talking about.
Right, exactly.
That I'm comfortable talking about. Okay.
That's okay.
Well, that narrows it down a little
bit.
That's
right.
I mean, I can remember regularly when we play in Italy, it just seems like, I remember one time, I mean, we'd get tear gas. We wouldn't get tear gas, but the audience would get tear gas because, you know, some of the venues, they'd sell it out, they'd oversell it, and there'd be hundreds of people outside trying to get in, literally trying to break in, and then the audience would, the police would stop it, you know, and they'd tear gas the audience, and, you know, it's just, but I recall one time we were playing, I think it was in Rome, and suddenly, right in this sort of center stage, about six rows back, and you have to mention they're all standing there, they're not sitting, this enormous fist fight broke out. I thought the stilettos were going to come out. These two guys were just going at each other, and everybody just kind of backed away, didn't pay the slightest bit of attention, like, ah, it's a fight. And,
oh, yeah,
and there
whatever.
Was this huge sort of open circle like a boxing ring, and everybody else was just standing watching. Meanwhile, these two guys are duking it out. There's nobody stopping it, and I just thought, and for them, this was just par for the course.
Y'all just kept playing.
We just kept playing, the audience kept listening, and the two guys kept fighting.
Sound like a soccer game.
That's kind of
I mean, there have been many, many incidents,
but
that comes to mind immediately.
Wow.
You know, it seems like you said, the Southern European thing goes a little crazy, because there was another gentleman mentioned about a wild thing happening in Greece, where they basically set off so many fireworks, they started up fires out in the crowd all over the hillside. It's really wild in that fact. But
they can be a little too over-enthusiastic.
Yes.
Well, we're kind of switching gears a little bit. I'm just wondering, what do you consider is your unique contribution to Tull's sound since you've been with them?
I don't know. I think you'd have to ask the other guys that. I think I would like to think I bring some stability and groundedness to the music. I've had an opportunity to play stylistically in so many different genres that I hope that gives me the feeling of whatever odd time signature we're playing in or unusual feel that I can make it feel good, and I want to try to make the technique of what we're doing and what I'm doing specifically appear invisible. So the main thing is I don't necessarily want to draw attention to the fact that maybe we're playing in unusual time signatures. I want it to groove for the audience. They don't need to know that.
Sure.
If I look out there and I see them moving, then I feel that I'm doing my job, and so that is part of what I hope I bring, and a musicality. Certainly, I have a deep appreciation of the music. Long before I was in the band, you know, I appreciated the music, and I appreciate it from the inside out now, and try to bring everything that I had experience-wise into the framework of Jethro Tull.
What are your favorite songs, Jethro Tull, and out of those, which ones that you thoroughly enjoy playing live?
Again, that's a really difficult question, because you got to remember there's over 300 pieces of music that we have played. You know, some of my favorite pieces of music, I mean, this tour, Slipstream, that's like a minute and a half long. I don't even play drums. I think I only play glockenspiel on that. And I love that piece of music. It's just a beautiful little piece of music. Same with Cheap Day Return. You know, I just play a little glockenspiel and some cymbal.
Wow.
great piece of music. Then on the other side of the country, there's Black Sunday, which I love playing. That we haven't played that in a while. Very challenging, exciting piece of music to play. There's such a number. I mean, I could go through it probably every album and pull out sections of music that I love to play. But they're not necessarily drumistic pieces of music. They might just be Wondering Aloud, another great piece of music. I don't even play on that one.
Right.
But there's lots of music from a musical point of view I enjoy listening to or being a part of. But to me, the experience of enjoying myself on stage is not necessarily related to playing stuff that is kind of big drum stuff all the time. I've certainly, over 21 years, had a chance to play some incredibly challenging, difficult music in this band. And this tour isn't as taxing in that way, because we're doing it sort of in two halves, with the first half being more acoustic, featuring that wonderful young violinist who's traveling with us, Lucia Micarelli.
Oh, yeah.
She's just a fantastic musician. And so we're playing some things with her that the audience have never heard before, and she's playing some of our stuff. But we're playing things that, from a physical point of view, this isn't as taxing as other tours have been, but that isn't how I necessarily measure my enjoyment out of playing a set. It's more the satisfaction of really playing really well as a band, playing with great feel and the right dynamics, and really having it hang together like a real, you know, a real cohesive musical ensemble. That, to me, is the challenge every night. It's climbing a mountain every night, and sometimes you feel like you got your hiking boots on, and other times I feel like I left them at home. But
exactly. What do you attribute your longevity to, Jethro Tull?
I mean, since you've been in, there's been quite a few personnel changes over the years, and we were just wondering, how did you stick, and some of the other guys just seem to move on?
I don't know. First of all, I love the music. I have great respect and love for the music. I think that's the bottom line. You know, I think it's almost as simple as that. I mean, I've just tried to play it really well. I try to play every night like it's the first night of the tour, because I'm aware that people are there that maybe have either, one, never seen Jethro Tull before. This may be their first and only time, and I want to give them something to remember. They go away and go, that was incredible. Or it may be their 100th time, and I still want them to go away thinking,
that was
incredible.
Absolutely.
Those guys really give it everything they have every night. And I really try very hard to no matter how I'm feeling, if I'm tired or not feeling well, I try to go out there and transcend all that and make it new for them and for myself. So that might be part of it, you know, just trying to keep it exciting, and you got to really pay attention. You could never on any musical job go on autopilot, and I couldn't dream of doing that on this job. I wouldn't do it on any gig, but I think that to be paying attention and be present, be in the music every second, not be thinking about after the gig or what happened, or you forgot to water the plants or feed the cat or whatever it is. You know,
exactly.
You have to be there right then, and that's what for me is the key to playing well every night.
We were lucky enough to bump into to Martin Barr as we walked in, and you worked with him on The Meeting. I was just wondering, what is it like to work with him even outside Tull?
Well, Martin, as Ian does, has very high standards about what he expects. Martin and I have toured together. I toured with him in Europe, and then last year he did a co-headlining tour with Willie Porter, who opened for us. And I played on that, and Jonathan and Andy actually played on that as well. And he's got, Martin is great to work with. I mean, he's obviously a different personality from Ian, but he has the same set of standards that, you know, you've got to come up with it every night. I mean, I love his guitar playing. I mean, I think Martin is such a tremendous, one of the real guitar greats.
Yes.
And without being kind of a histrionic, noodly guitar player, Martin has a great sense of phrasing and note placement. He doesn't play too much, and he plays the right thing, and very unique. And Martin has a great sonic identity. When he plays, you know it's him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the diversity of his albums, all of them, and I just find them to be diverse. and you have to listen to him quite frequently, you can't keep up with what all he's doing on them, and it's just wonderful. And is Ian Anderson much the same? Is he very demanding in the studio?
Yeah, he is, but, you know, he's no more demanding of any of us than I am of myself, certainly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody could ask more of me than I will ask every time I sit down behind the kit. Every time, you know, so... And I think Ian recognizes that, so he knows, and Ian knows when it's right to sort of push you or encourage you about something, and when it's good to lay back and let you get on with it, because he can see right if we're going down the right road here. I mean, when we were doing Roots to Branches, I remember he came in with one day we were working on A Rare and Precious Chain, and he brought it in, and it would start it in the morning as one thing. And then suddenly, and then I kind of came up with this sort of kind of off-the-wall drum part, and then Andy started playing. So suddenly the music went off in a different direction, and he knew, let them go with it. And he just disappeared from the studio for, you know, hours at a time, and he kind of put his head back in periodically, make some, you know, important comments. And then at the end of the day, and then he put all his stuff on at the end, we had a different piece of music. Other times he'll be very, very specific about things he wants. And so I think Ian is smart enough to realize when it's good to you know, push the musicians in a certain direction, when it's good to lay back and let them get on with it. And that way, that and you know, you have to know that when you're working with other musicians, that you have a that's how you get the best performances out of them. So,
well, when you're apart from Tull, when you say have some time to yourself, do you prefer session work over live performance with other artists, or?
I get to play live so much with Jethro Tull that I'm not actively seeking live work. People do call me, and I do some live work with certain people I want to from time to time. It's more session work because also I travel so much that I don't want to do a lot of traveling outside of Tull these days, though I have a couple of potential offers that if I can fit them in comfortably time-wise, I might try to do that. But what I really enjoy doing, if I'm not doing session work, is composing in my studio. So that is that is probably how I spend my time musically when I'm not if I'm not actively working with other people.
Gotcha. Is there a particular Tull album that you just say, this is one of the best?
Personal favorite.
Well, starting with personal favorites that I've been on, I guess, putting them all together, probably close to a dozen different Tull records, but my personal favorite, I would have to say, would be Roots to Branches. There was a lot of things that all converged, a lot of elements that all converged there on that album that was particularly meaningful for me. In terms of other albums, I like so many of them. I think Under Wraps is a hugely underrated album. And for some reason, that doesn't seem to, you know, get the attention, you know, as far as Tull albums go, that others get. I love the A album. I mean, I love the early record. I have to say, you know, I love them all for different reasons.
You've got to have a few favorite drummers out there. Who might they be?
Paco Seri from Joe Zawinul Syndicate is one. I just love his playing. Back to lots of, you know, jazz guys, big band players. I always feel like I'm leaving out so many. All the drummers of Weather Report. A lot of young players today. Steve Gadd, I'd have to mention, is just an all-around great drummer. Steve Smith, Vinnie Colaiuta. I feel like I'm just John Bonham. Oh, I'm leaving out so many. You know, so I'm almost always loath to start a list there, because I also feel like, you know, there's too many that are going to get left out. Same with people say, well, who are your favorite writers? It's the same thing.
Look out.
There's just so many.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, we're about concluded here. On behalf of me, Brian, and Tom, and our other partner, Mike Arnold, who couldn't be here.
This is Tom Thompson signing off.
And Brian Hasbrook. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
I want to thank you for letting me be myself again.